honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with decorated Navy pilot Jim Lloyd of New Mexico. In a moment, he's going to start describing the most unforgettable night of his life, August 6th, 1972. It would be the 100th time he took off from an aircraft carrier for a mission. And since he was giving us a feel for some of the things that can go wrong when taking off or landing on an aircraft carrier, I have to at least ask the question, right?
All 99 of those leading up to your 100th mission were just flawless carrier landings, night, day, whenever? You did them all perfectly?
Oh, if I said that, any Navy pilot sitting in the audience would laugh at me. No, you have your time. I didn't do any dangerous landings, but, there, you know, I bolted a few times. And it's like I say, that's when you fly over the wires. And you might get a hook skip that does that, and that's not your fault. But if you're a little overpowered, yeah, you could bolt. Then you got to just come around and do it again. You get your share of those. You get wave-offs. I don't remember having too many of those for my performance, but sometimes the plane ahead of you is slow getting out of the wires, and the wave is called a foul deck wave off. But I'm sure I had a few wave offs, you know, for not being set up right and whatever. But if you get an okay pass, that's the best you can get, is the okay. There's nothing better than that. And if it's enough control, changing in attitude, changing in direction, and speed like that, they'll downgrade it to a fair, which fair pass is all right. It's safe. And there's worse ones than that, but okay with no comment is the best you can get. And I had a few of those that I really like, make you feel good. But it depends on the situation. Sometimes you're really psyched, you mean shot at really bad, or you lost somebody on that flight. You're coming back and you're shook up. The deck is pitching, and it might be 2 a.m. And visibility is poor. You got a lot of things against you. So having perfect passes is something you dream about, and hope for. But they don't happen all the time.
And you made reference to something there that I wanted to touch on before we get into August 6th of 72. You mentioned coming back and maybe you lost somebody that day. I was interested to know what your relationship was like with the other pilots in your squadron or other people you interacted with aboard ship.
Even by the end of the 10.5 month cruise, I didn't know everybody really well. I could identify everybody, but I didn't know the other squadrons in the air wing. But I had a lot of friends in the different squadrons. And, of course, our squadron, you come really close to. You're living with them right there in the same quarters in that particular part of the ship. When you lose somebody, it's really hard on you. And you realize once you lose somebody that, you know, it could happen. Even, you know, it was over 50 years ago, and I think of those people, and I still find it very upsetting knowing that they never got past their 20s.
And of course, you know, there's one spot in Washington, D.C. that so many Vietnam veterans have gone to, and now the honor flights from all over the country, including here in northern New Mexico, are taking veterans back to see things like that. Is that something where a guy that you lost, you've gone to the wall and you've looked at his name, you've thought about him?
Part of my career, I spent several years in D.C., and yes, we go to the wall. The feeling I got is when I'd see the name there of one of my friends, it just set deeply the permanency of it, that it is real. It's just not something I dreamt about, or maybe he made it or whatever, and I just didn't remember it right or whatever. But any slim as it was, hope that the person wasn't killed is confirmed, and seeing the name was emotional.
And I don't want to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth, but after we hear the story of August 6th of 1972, I'm sure a lot of people listening are going to say, man, his name easily could have been on that wall about 50 different times during that night. Is that something you've ever consciously thought when you're at the wall?
Yeah, I thought of that. I thought, what if I, of course, I could have been on the wall and wouldn't be there looking at it, but the part I get about it is I think, what if it was my brother on the wall? Because he had obviously a close call. And we're just both so grateful that we're not.
Well, so unless there's something else you want to throw in beforehand, let's hear that the incredible, I don't know what you'd call it, ordeal that you endured on August 6th of 1972, because there's so many little details that could have changed the whole story. How did that day start, and take us through it from start to finish?
I can't recall what mission I had during the day, but I had a mission over there, and I was getting ready for a night mission, and this other pilot and I were assigned to go after enemy trucks that were reported up near the Vinson area in North Vietnam that were moving supplies south. As we were getting ready to go, the guy I was with, his plane went down, had mechanical problems. So they launched me anyway, but they wouldn't send a single-seat aircraft over the north by himself for obvious reasons. Another section, which is a two-plane formation from our carrier, launched. I was getting ready to launch, and the flight leader of that, I'm going to mention names, Lieutenant Commander Art Bell, who was an absolutely superb combat pilot. His wingman went down on the carrier for also mechanical problems, so they launched him, and they asked me to join him. And so we went after the trucks together, and frankly, speaking, that was the first miracle because of what Art did and was able to do. I don't think most pilots could, and locating where I was. So anyway, by the time we went, we call feet dry into North Vietnam, it was dark. We got up to the area. The anti-aircraft fire was spotty, and I thought this is going to be a piece of cake. We'll be done in an hour and get back to the ship and watch a movie, take a shower, get a bite to eat before going hitting the rack. I rolled in on a 45 dive delivery. And incidentally, when you're flying at night, at least back in those days, you obviously have your lights off and you can't see each other either. So you talk to each other and keep tabs, try to keep quite a bit of separation for obvious reasons. So I'm not sure if he was facing away or facing toward me. I rolled in and I pulled off and I rolled over to evaluate my hit so I could report it to the ship when I got back. When I got the bomb was going off on the trucks. And I got an indication in the cockpit of it being painted by the Fansong. I got the warble. I got the SAM alert light. And then it changed to the warble. And then I looked off to the distance and the direction that it was pointing to. And I could see about 10 miles away a big fireball arcing up to the dark sky. And coming toward me. And I tell people, remind them that at night, your human eye doesn't have very good depth perception. And if I turn too soon, it would give the SAM, it's coming up now three times the speed of sound, an opportunity to arc with me. And if I waited too late to do it, it had a 500-foot kill radius, and so I might have been caught in that radius. And I was pumping shaft to confuse the radar, but this fireball just kept coming up at me. I could see a dark center in the middle of the fireball, which was the nose cone. I figured it's time to break. So I did break, and I could feel it screaming by me, missing me. But what I didn't know is they fired another SAM from behind, and my ECM gear that it was making the noises was going to give you just one indication if it's one or more, and I didn't know about it. And it blew up next to me, and it took off my left wing. The plane immediately went into a nose down, falling. I realized I got to get out, and we have a face curtain we pull down. That's the preferred method because it straightens your back. And it protects your face. Or if you're real, got to get out now and can't take your hands off the controls, you just pull the D-ring that's between your legs. I pulled it, and it seemed like forever, because nothing happened. Well, it was my state of mind, because in 0.2 seconds, the system sequence started, the canopy blew, and I started going up the rails. But what happened in my mind is I looked down to see if it hung up on my anti-blackout suit or my G-suit, and then the seat fired, and so I didn't realize it at the time, but they gave me a double break up compression fracture of the neck when I went out. As I left, all I remember is a sudden rush of air, the red instrument lights pulling away, and then a second or two later, the plane blowing up, and I went horizontally over right at the edge of the fireball, swung twice, and landed at a big hard landing, but I landed and didn't break anything.
Just one quick question there. You said something I want to zoom in on here. Right after you ejected, the plane blew up. So if you had waited another second or two to pull that D-ring, you wouldn't be here?
I wouldn't be there. Even if I got out, then I'd be out of the safety envelope of the seat. I mean, they're tremendous seats, and the engineers that put them and design them together and put them together do a tremendous job, but they got their limits. You got to give it a little bit of a opportunity for it to get you out. And a guy my size, 185 pounds, 6'2", is probably 200 feet, 250 feet, it blows you up if you're just sitting on the ground. So it's a pretty good kick in the seat. And then you got air bladders that push you away from the mechanical metal seat as you come out, and then your parachute opens if you're below 13,500 feet automatically. You try to beat it in case there's a malfunction, but it happens so fast. They're miracles, those seats. They get you out.
What was your estimated altitude when you ejected?
Well, all I remember is seeing 2,000 feet screaming through the altimeter, and that'd be 2,000 feet above sea level. I have no idea about how high off the ground. I'm guessing it might be anywhere from 50 to a couple hundred feet, the elevation of the ground. There wasn't any mountains below me. It was all open rice paddies and fields. So I was probably around a little less than 2,000 feet above the ground when I got out, but things happen so fast.
And that's less than ideal.
Less than ideal. I actually, looking back, I thought I'd be out of the safety envelope of the seat.
And so you said you swung twice and hit the ground.
I hit the ground on a swing and knocked the wind out of myself. I don't remember getting out of my parachute, my helmet, or the seat pan. That's the survival pan that stays with you after you separate from the metal seat. And I just remember running. The fireball was right there, so it was cooking off the 200 millimeter. My two machine guns were popping off. I was afraid of any of the surviving 500-pound bombs that go off, which was got a 3,000-foot kill radius. So I had to get away from those. And then also the light of it was just giving me away. And as I ran, I have no idea how far I went. I got down behind a little clump of what I refer to as razor grass. It was real sharp grass, about 2-3 feet high, and squatted in it and just sort of tried to assess the situation. There was literally 100, if not more, North Vietnamese coming out of the village just screaming and yelling. And I have no idea how many were the paramilitia, how many were villagers, and a lot of the villagers were armed anyway, and how many were the soldiers. But they were all over the place in the open fields. But it was very, very dark. Another miracle for me. And I got behind this little clump of grass and tried to assess the situation. I put mud on my hands and face to cut the skin tones, and also the mosquitoes were terrible. I remember I thought I saw flashlights coming, and one flashlight would be over with. But there were fireflies, big fireflies up close, and I was thinking it might be lights in the distance. And talk about a relief. So I finally got one of my two radios out of my flight gear and called up Art, who was overhead. Of course, he knew from when you eject, you send a beeper coming off your seat. It goes on every radio frequency. It tells him that I got out, but it doesn't tell him if I made it out or if I'm killed on the ground or whatever. And I told him I was alive. And I had literally people 6 feet and stop and look right at me, and I'm in the open, and they wouldn't see me. Anyway, when I had a chance, when they move around looking, I called him up and told him I was alive. He said, Lieutenant Commander Bernie Smith, who was our ops officer, was another tremendous pilot, was inbound to help him. So Bernie, I could hear him on the radio calling me on my little handheld radio, but he could only hear static when I called back. So he said, Jim, Mike, key me in. Left, two, right, one. And well, he had his lights on, and he's flying low and very fast, and everybody was shooting at him. I was really surprised. Not only there were more people there than I thought, but there were also, seemed like everybody had some kind of a firearm. And they were shooting at him, and Mike did keyed him in, and then when he was overhead, I told him, okay, you're overhead now. And he was either being painted by radar from a destroyer or one of the E-2 surveillance planes that we had flying over the Gulf or the South China Sea. They never went overland. He told them, and they're watching him, so they had a rough idea where I was. We didn't have any of the fancy gear we have today with GPS, satellite imaging, or any of that kind of stuff. And then I told him to turn his lights off. I didn't want any company down there. They told me that a helicopter was coming in. And I looked around. I wanted to get out of there so bad. I was emotionally a wreck. And I'll get into that in a minute. But I told him, I said, there's no way a slow mover is going to survive this. And so I said, turn him back. I'll have to call him. Went in later. I got to move. I was going through shock. You know, 1 minute I'm flying an airplane, it's comfortable cockpit, familiar cockpit, and a shower and an hour and a half away. And now I'm in the enemy's backyard. I was 150 miles north of DMZ, 21 miles in from the coast, in an area I was told when I got back that no Americans were ever seen again that went down that area. Wide open spaces and people all around.
So with that in mind, how in the world is he still with us? We're going to hear it in Jim Lloyd's own words, but we're going to have to wait till next time because time has run out on this episode of Hometown Heroes. How many more miracles did Jim experience on August 6, 1972? And what kind of perspective has it given him 50 years later? Don't forget to visit hometownheroesradio.com for photos of Jim then and now. And join us again next time for the rest of his story when we'll see and hear even more clearly that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.